Today on Maine Calling, the significance of Juneteenth. Wednesday marks the newest national holiday. To many people, Juneteenth commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. But the story of its origins is more complicated than that. And still today, the holiday means different things to different people, from a day for picnics and parties to a time for reflection on the hardships our ancestors faced or what still needs to happen in our country. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn about the history of Juneteenth, how it's been celebrated through the decades, and how it's being celebrated this week in Maine. We'll also explore how the tradition of oral histories ties into Juneteenth. What will you be doing this Wednesday? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today we're learning about the meaning of Juneteenth, the stories behind it, and how the holiday is celebrated. Joining me, Kelly Elaine Navies, a museum specialist and oral historian with the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, and Bob Green, a journalist with a focus on Maine's Black history. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about Juneteenth? Have you celebrated it in the past, or do you plan to this Wednesday? Send us a brief email, please, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, as always, 1-800-399-3566. Also, I want to note that our colleagues at Maine Public Classical will have a full day of Black artistry on Wednesday, June 19th, from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. It will include selections from more than 40 living and historical composers. So be sure and tune in to Maine Public Classical on Wednesday. And thank you to both of you for joining us today. We've already had people comment, why are you doing this program today when Wednesday is Juneteenth? And one of the reasons is if we're talking about events that are happening on Wednesday, we want people to know about them in advance so they can plan for them. But so Kelly Elaine, I want to start with you though. I've heard a couple things about the origins of Juneteenth. And we'll just start with this. Is it true that the roots of this holiday took place in Galveston, Texas, that enslaved people there were the last to hear about the Emancipation Proclamation? Or is that sort of like a watered down urban myth?
Well, part of that is a myth. It is true that Juneteenth started in Galveston, Texas. Juneteenth is the day, June 19th, 1865, when General Granger arrived in Galveston with a force of 1,800 Union troops, many of whom were United States colored troops, by the way, to announce that slavery had ended. But it wasn't that the people there didn't know. That part is the myth. News travels. What it is that the Emancipation Proclamation could only be enforced in states where there was a Union presence. Confederates did not recognize the authority of the United States government. Texas, being the westernmost slave-owning state, continued to hold slaves even after the end of the Civil War, which had ended April of that year. They were, you know, they were determined to maintain the institution of slavery regardless of what the United States government said. So it required the presence of Union troops arriving on that day. And that's why June 19th is significant. And it was first celebrated a year after that particular announcement in Texas, and was celebrated throughout Texas until the present day, from that moment on, has been.
And you said was celebrated in Texas. Has it been for the last 16 decades? And for the last 16 decades, has it been celebrated other places, or pretty much until recently, mainly in Texas?
So it's been celebrated in other places. It's been celebrated in Oklahoma for a long time. And actually, it's been celebrated in California because, as you know, due to the Great Migration, lots of African Americans traveled from Texas to California. My family celebrated it in California, in the California Bay Area, in fact. So it was celebrated in other places, but lots of people still didn't know about it. And also, other states have their own Emancipation Days. Like Washington, D.C. has an Emancipation Day of April 16th, when the slaves were freed in this particular district. So other places have their own Emancipation Days and did not necessarily need to recognize Juneteenth. But as we know, Juneteenth is now a federal holiday, so it has become nationwide.
All right. Well, Bob, I want to turn to you. Maine is obviously not a southern state, but Maine's history with slavery is more fraught than many people would like to acknowledge, correct?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit. Patricia Wall wrote a fantastic book, and she found at least 500 black folks that were enslaved in the Kittery area of Maine. Of course, that was before Maine became a state, but we were part of Massachusetts at that time. And you'll find slaves throughout the state. The last slaves that I actually found in the census was in 1820, the year Maine became a state. There was a family of 10 in Bristol, Maine, listed as slaves in the census.
I'm wondering, has Juneteenth meant something to people in Maine? Have people here celebrated it? Or is this a new holiday here?
Yes and no on that one. I born and grew up in the state, and I don't remember hearing about it until I was a journalist out in the Midwest. But I do know that we've had people from away come to move to Maine and have brought the holiday with them. There's one gentleman in Portland that I have heard about. Has celebrated for the last, oh, at least last 10 or 15 years.
And that's exactly how it's traveled, Bob. It's traveled by African Americans taking it with them wherever they migrate throughout the United States. And I know in my particular case, we didn't start celebrating it until 1969, which is a year after the Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C. And what happened there, you had activists from throughout the country converge on Washington, D.C., but they ended their campaign, which was a campaign to advocate for the rights of poor people of all races, colors, and creeds throughout the nation. But they ended their campaign on June 19th, and they called that Solidarity Day. So a lot of those activists were celebrating Juneteenth for the first time, and they took it across the country. So you see that it gained some popularity in the late 60s due to that particular event.
Kelly Elaine, I understand you have a personal connection to Juneteenth. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I do. As I was referencing, so my father was an educator, activist. We do not have Texas roots, but he learned about Juneteenth right around the time. And he's not here for me to confirm this, but he probably learned about it right after the Poor People's Campaign, because again, we started celebrating in 1969 when our family moved from Detroit to Berkeley, California, and we celebrated it there all throughout my childhood. And now it's actually the city of Berkeley celebrates Juneteenth, and I think in no small part because of the celebrations that my father used to hold, but also because there are lots of Texas transplants in the
And
California.
what will you be doing on Wednesday? How will you celebrate the day?
Interesting. This is the first year in many, many years that my family here in Maryland is not holding our own Juneteenth. And I think that's because there's so many other Juneteenths happening around the town and the country. A lot of my relatives are traveling to different places. I'm planning to go to Annapolis this Wednesday and to celebrate there, which, as some of you may know, is where they have the monument to Alex Haley and Roots and his family that came in to Annapolis. But they're going to have a live concert in celebration of Juneteenth on that day. And
And
actually, I've been Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so it's gone from something that's families did, or maybe extended families or neighborhoods, now to something that's kind of more official and more like other holidays.
In some ways, it's been like that for years. I mean, it's been a state holiday in Texas for a long time, and Oklahoma, and they've had citywide festivals and parades for years. So now that's just expanding. And yes, it has evolved and changed in many ways, the way holidays do. So, yes.
Bob, what will you be doing on Wednesday?
I more than likely will be attending a Juneteenth celebration in Lewiston. I live in Minot, I'm about 9 or 10 miles from Lewiston. So I probably will go to their celebration to see what it's like. One of the things that I find interesting, though, is that, as Kelly pointed out, Black folks knew what was happening. We had a very great communication system.
Absolutely.
Because 20 to 40% is according to what numbers you look at, of the sailors during the period that we're talking about were Black. And most of the dock workers in the United States, especially on the East Coast and in the down in around Louisiana, were Black until the Irish came. So there were at least two states, South Carolina and Louisiana, both passed laws to keep Black sailors aboard the ship when the ship was in port so that they couldn't come on shore and tell them the news what was going on.
Yes.
So you stop to think that the Emancipation Proclamation was announced on January 1, 1863.
Right.
Granger didn't speak until 1865. And by the way, that was 5-6 months after Congress had passed the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. So Black folks knew what was going on. And Emancipation Day, actually, or Juneteenth Day, as we call it, actually was the United States government saying for the first time, we're going to back our laws.
Yes, exactly.
And so a lot of places in Texas, you'll hear it called Freedom Day.
Mm-hmm.
And also a year after the first, as Kelly pointed, the first Juneteenth celebration took place in Texas the following year. And it took place in parks that Black citizens pooled their money together and bought.
Yes, because they had to. Otherwise, there would be no place for them to celebrate Juneteenth.
There you go.
That's exactly right.
So they bought, what did they buy?
So, one of the first parks they bought was in Houston.
Okay, they bought a park, yeah.
Well, it was a plot of land, Reverend Jack Yates. It became a park. It became known as Emancipation Park. Reverend Jack Yates was a leader who gathered the community together in Houston, and they did exactly what Bob was referring to. They pooled their funds and they purchased this land because laws had been passed to stop groups of Blacks from coming together. So they had to have their own space, so they wouldn't be able to celebrate. And you find that this ended up happening in cities throughout the South, and you'll find these Emancipation Parks that are the result of that particular activity, Blacks coming together to create a space so that they can celebrate their freedom.
I believe I've seen a park that has that name, Emancipation Park, but never understood what it was exactly. So it was a group of Black people coming together, buying a piece of land and turning it specifically into a park as a place they could come together. Go ahead,
into
Bob.
A city park.
Yeah.
It wasn't a private park. This was a park for all to come.
That's
what's
right.
Interesting in the Houston Emancipation Park, which they bought and started in 1866, is that was the only place that Blacks could swim until 1955 in Houston.
That's That's right. Jim Crow. So the Jim Crow laws were instituted. So these parks were not only, I mean, they literally couldn't go to other city parks.
Yeah. And the legacy of that lives on. I know people who are working to help more people, more Black people, more people of color learn to swim because so there was so much exclusion for so long in public pools. We do need to go to a break. I want to ask you all in the coming up minutes we have about what this holiday means to you. Do you think of it as a celebratory holiday or something, a time of reflection and how we all might reflect on it? But and also coming up, we're going to learn more about some of the celebrations around Maine. We're talking about Juneteenth on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, the significance of Juneteenth and how it's celebrated. And we'll also be discussing how oral histories matter in recording the past. My guest today, Bob Green, longtime journalist and author and Maine historian, and Kelly Elaine Navies, museum specialist and oral historian with the National Museum of African American History and Culture. You can share your comments and questions, email talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Angela Okafor, who is a Community Engagement Director for the Permanent Commission on the Status of Racial, Indigenous, and Tribal Populations. Thank you so much for calling in, Angela. And what is the role of the commission in promoting awareness of Juneteenth?
Thank you for having me. So the Permanent Commission on the Status of Racial, Indigenous, and Tribal Populations, this is actually the first year that we are really, really getting involved and excitedly doing so with the Juneteenth celebration in Maine. One of the first and biggest things we've done this year, or we're doing this year, is publishing an online map and the calendar of Juneteenth celebrations across Maine. Thank you to our partner in doing this, Athena Lynch, who has historically been mapping this event. And if you look at the map, you will see how much this event has grown. To access this calendar, you can visit our website on pcrit.me/Juneteenth2024. On that page, you can find this map from under the home page and under the calendar menu.
I was going to say, we'll be sure, and a lot of people don't listen to the radio with a pen in their hand. So what we'll do, Angela, is we'll make sure and link that on both of our website and our Facebook page. So if people want to find it, they can just go to the Maine Calling Facebook page, look at today's post, click on that. No problem. But would you highlight a few different celebrations? What are some of the celebrations that you think will be well attended and most exciting for people?
We actually, there are about 22 events happening across Maine this year, with seven of those, the Permanent Commission sponsored seven of those events to happen this year. So some of the ones that we, the Permanent Commission sponsored are from Maine Inside Out events happening in Lewiston to the Portland Public Library event happening to the third place. Happening also, and One Westbrook, we have the Community Organizing Alliance event too happening. Atlantic Black Box is also partnering with the third place. There is the Maine Irish Heritage Center event. There is the NAACP in Bangor happening also. And we have several different activities. We have the Juneteenth Down East happening. Several of these events are from educational, celebratory, a lot of activities centering the African-American community and the emancipation and what it all means in our community today. And some of them also connecting this community to the outside space, the water, CPR, wellness, and all of the different things happening this year. We are pretty very excited, but we also remind people to stay hydrated,
especially because it's going to be hot. That's right. Angela, let me ask you this. So many of the folks in Maine who are Black are people who are immigrants, who do not have a personal history of ancestors who were enslaved in the United States. What does Juneteenth mean to immigrants in Maine who are Black but have only been in this country for a little while?
Talking about that, I'm also an immigrant, and I'm grateful. You know, the thing with everybody and community building is, and growth, is everybody understanding their background and their history. As an immigrant, I'm always very grateful for the sacrifices of, you know, people who have that personal connection to slavery, because someone like me, like I said, an immigrant, I wouldn't be here if not for those sacrifices. So I always, always honor that. I appreciate my place. And I appreciate the sacrifices that made it possible for me to be here. So Juneteenth for me is commemorating and remembering and celebrating with gratitude the people who have that personal connection due to the history and the trauma that they continue to live today, and lending my voice and support in every little way that I could to ensure that this community keeps being centered in ways that they deserve to be.
Oh, Angela, thank you so much for that really thoughtful response. Angela Okafor is with the Permanent Commission on the Status of Racial, Indigenous, and Tribal Populations. And I was just wondering, Bob, when you heard Angela say that, what is your response to perhaps thinking of this as a day of appreciation for those who came before?
It is, but, you know, and I know Angela, and I was so happy that she was able to join us. But it also reminded me that there is a immigrant population that has no clue as to what went on in this country. I, at one point, was asked to speak to a group of immigrants from the Democratic Republic of Congo to tell them about slavery. And the second surprise that I got when I gave this speech was that it all had to be translated into French, because that was their language. So all of us do not have the same background. I first heard about Juneteenth when I was working on a Black weekly newspaper in Kansas City. We had a Texas edition, and so we talked about Juneteenth and that. So that was the first time I heard it. So it was after I had come out of college, so it was I was getting up in life, so to speak. But it was interesting that at that time in Kansas City, I didn't hear that much about it. But you later on, it came there, and it spread now, of course, across the country.
Mm. Kelly Elaine, what are your thoughts about those who are in this country who would be called Black by most people, but are not part of the same heritage that you and Bob are?
Well, I think that that's one of the wonderful things about Juneteenth. I mean, Juneteenth is a moment that it's a teachable moment. It's a time where we can educate people who live here, who may be a part of the African diaspora, but did not experience enslavement in this country, and others who aren't a part of the African diaspora, because this is American history. And if you're going to be a citizen of this nation, of any race, of any culture, then you should understand the history of the United States of America. And so Juneteenth gives us a chance to educate these other people from these other places. And I like the way Angela put it, and I appreciate her stating the respect for the struggles of the people in this country, because if you're living here today, all of us stand on the shoulders of those who were enslaved, who built much of this country. So I think that it's a time that all people should celebrate and take and use it as a time to learn. Why are we celebrating? You can't just celebrate without understanding the need for the celebration, and that is looking to the roots of that experience of enslavement in this country.
Calling in now is Anthony Walton, who is a poet and senior writer in residence at Bowdoin College. Thanks so much for calling in, Anthony.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You just heard what Kelly Elaine said. Why do you think it's important for Americans to recognize Juneteenth?
Well, first, I very much agree with and endorse what she said. And what I would add is it's such a kind of multifaceted holiday that represents so much of what we have experienced as a nation. It's the end of something, but it's also the beginning of something. It's kind of the beginning of the second nation or organization of our country. It was certainly a beginning for African Americans, but I also think of it as more than just an African American holiday, and I think that it's something that whites and other groups can also celebrate and embrace, because I think it means a lot to them as well, and I think we should remember that.
Yeah, when you talk with your students about Juneteenth and maybe give them some guidance on what they might do or think about on Wednesday, what do you say to them?
Well, I say that it's an example of what our country can achieve. We've had several moments like that. I think Juneteenth and the end of the Civil War in particular stand out because it was an opportunity to right a kind of tremendous wrong that our society had in the past. And it gave us a chance to begin again. And while we are still on this road of rebuilding, redeeming, changing, that was the beginning of it. And we are now able to do this work.
For you, Anthony, is this a day of celebration? Are you going to have a great meal, or is it something more somber?
It's a day of both. First of all, it's a day of contemplation. And then within that, words that I will be thinking about are remembrance, but also joy, also hope. And it's interesting in that way because it is a very somber day, because we want to remember the ancestors and remember their endurance and how, as your guest said, we are building upon what they did, and we can never forget that. And that's what I try to always emphasize to young people, that you are here because of them and because of their willingness to survive, their endurance. And again, I think that that applies not just to African Americans, but to the entire nation, to people of all ethnicities. And it's just something that we can't forget. And that's why I think Juneteenth has become such an important date and will be, I think, ever more in the future, because it marks that endurance.
I understand, Anthony, that there's a Martin Luther King quote you share with your students and others.
Yes, and I think that it's a great description of African-American life, American life, all of us. It's we ain't what we want to be. We ain't what we should be. We ain't what we're going to be. But thank God we ain't what we was. And I think that that speaks to the ongoing American project. It's not what it should be, but it's not what it was.
Right.
Well, Anthony, thank you so much for calling in. Anthony Walton is Bowdoin College senior writer in residence, and I appreciate you taking the time today. Something we haven't talked about yet, Kelly Elaine, is the importance of oral history in not only understanding Juneteenth, but understanding Black history in America. And I understand this is your specialty. So talk to me about how you think oral history has been maybe overlooked in the past, and why we need to be really paying attention.
Yes. First, I want to thank Anthony for those comments, too. I resonate with a lot of what he said about why we celebrate Juneteenth. So, but oral history is very important for most of the history of this country, and up until the mid to late 20th century, the discipline of academic history relied upon and privileged written documents, diaries, property deeds, letters, things that the educated and those with means left. And so that left out the voices of people who were illiterate, like the enslaved, people who couldn't vote, like women, people who, were the working class, so working class of all races. And oral history began to emerge in the mid to late 20th century as a way to remedy some of that disparity in the study of history. And I would say that it has been growing ever since and now has gotten a lot more popular, but it's a very important way that that we can access the voices of those that have been traditionally left out of the historical record. In terms of Juneteenth, it's very important. We know about Juneteenth largely because of the oral tradition, and oral history, of course, evolves from that oral tradition. What we know about the early Juneteenth is that the formerly enslaved who were still there, right, people who had actually experienced slavery, would share their stories of what that experience was like. And so that oral tradition was very important to passing on to the next generations what their forebears had gone through. At our Juneteenth, in our family, we always had different generations. We would have an open mic where people could get up and share. And so we would have, and it was very important that everyone was involved. And we would make sure that the children were involved. The children would share. The children would share poems, Black poetry, and performances. But the elders would also have a chance to get up and talk. And it's very important because, especially now, we have very few spaces where the elders are talking to young people. And they would share their stories of living in segregation or being a part of the civil rights movement at the Juneteenth. And then after we had this moment of sharing, of course, then we would have the celebration. At the National Museum of African American History and Culture, in our oral history initiative, we collect oral histories to supplement the work of the curators. So we have collections that speak to the Poor People's Campaign that I was talking about earlier, for example, social justice movements, also the arts, things that people say that are not necessarily written down anywhere else. And so it's very important to capture these records.
Yeah, I imagine it's tricky, though, because we've all played that game of telephone where, you start at the line and you pass something down. And by the end, it's not quite the same story. And so how do you, in the work you do, do you sort of gather a lot when you're talking about one event or one memory, get as many oral histories as possible and see which ones have a lot in common and where somebody might be remembering a little differently?
You know, it's interesting that I always get that kind of question, but that's the same for written records.
Oh, that's
written
right.
Records are the same way. Those are also interpretations.
That's
so
right.
So you cannot always rely on the things that people write.
Yeah,
down.
And why do we say that written is better than oral? Right. That's right.
I don't know why we think that written records, especially when you're talking about African American history, are more reliable than the oral tradition, when often outright lies were written about the lives and experiences of African Americans. So historians have to take all of their sources into account. They have to take the oral sources, they have to look at written records, they have to compare that with newspaper records. They're, you know, it's all an interpretation, memory. Everything we write down is an interpretation. So any oral historian is looking at multiple sources. I have found as an oral historian that what people remember factually is more often true than not. I'll give you an example of that. I became an oral historian because my mother would talk about her great-grandmother who was born in slavery. And she had met her because she lived to be over 100 years old. And she would say, I met my great-grandmother. She lived to be over 100 years old. I met her when I was a little girl, right? She only met her one time. She was born into slavery in North Carolina. And then she would say, I think she was born in Africa. So later, when I became an oral historian and I went around and I interviewed my grandmother's siblings who knew this woman who was their grandmother very closely, I found out that almost everything my mother said was true, except the part about her being born in Africa, right? That part wasn't true. The family went back several generations in Western North Carolina. So I had to do my due diligence and research to discover that, but 99% of what she said was true. There was actually an obituary printed when she died because she lived to be over 100 years old. So all of that you know, was true. So most of that story was true. And I have found that it's not that people will, you know, consciously make up stories. Our memories can play tricks on us, but you also learn different things from oral histories. You learn like what is important to that person and why are they remembering a certain thing. And that's the other thing that's important about oral history. So you're not just studying, you know, the actual facts, which is important, but you're also studying the way that people tell stories and why they remember certain things and why are certain things so important to a particular community. Like, why would one community continuously talk about the demolition of a particular building, which is another research project that I worked on, where the segregated high school was knocked down. And that's because that had an impact on that entire community. And so from oral histories, you learn that. That's not something that you would really see written anywhere else, that a generation later, people are still talking about the pain that they felt when their high school was knocked down, for example. And then you also capture the way that people speak, right? Their dialects, the sound of their voices. And that's something else that can't be recreated years later. The way we speak is changing every day.
Well, Kelly, Elena, I have more questions about oral history. And I also want to ask my audience if they have questions about Juneteenth or about oral history. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are discussing the meaning of Juneteenth and the role of oral histories. My guest today, Kelly Elaine Navies with the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, and Bob Green, journalist and Maine historian. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566 or send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. And I also want to note that our colleagues at Maine Public Classical will have a full day of Black artistry on Wednesday, June 19th from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m., including selections from more than 40 living and historical composers. So before the break, we were talking about the role of oral history. And Bob, I want to ask you if there are any stories that were passed down in your family that you were thinking of as Kelly Elaine was talking about how oral histories tell us what were important to people in the past.
She is so true. And I'm learning quite a bit from her and listening to what she has to say. I grew up on top of Munjoy Hill in Portland. And in the household was not only my mother, but my grandmother who owned the house and my grandmother's aunt. So there were at least four generations there. And just listening at the dinner table, you learned a lot about the history of the family. If you stop to think about it, this program is one of the things about Juneteenth. It's letting all of us know the history of what has happened in this country. And I think that's good. It's great. And it's a history that is being oral right now.
that experience you had with the multi-generational dinner table, that is so rare these days and so,
yes,
so special. Yeah.
Yeah. Kelly Elaine, I wanted to ask you about the role of trauma in personal history, in oral history, because we hear over and over again, whether it's, you know, Vietnam veterans who don't want to talk about their experience or people who lived through the last pandemic. One of the reasons we didn't know much about the last pandemic is because people didn't talk about it because it was so horrible. And how do you, when you, as a historian, and you're trying to tease out these important histories of communities, Black communities, there is also the reality that there was horrible trauma, and certainly many, many people chose not to speak about it. So I'm just wondering how you look at that, how you study that, how you weight different oral histories given that reality.
That is such an excellent question, and you're right. It is, and when you're doing oral history, when you're doing the oral history of African Americans, largely of the 20th century, you definitely are dealing with traumatic experiences. And it's something that I often have to deal with. And the heart of oral history is really trust. people only share stories with you because they have a sense of trust of in sharing their story with you and what you plan to do with that story. So first of all, that's essential to doing any oral history. And I have to prepare myself as an individual for these stories. And then I also have to make sure that I'm sensitive to what the person is going through that is sharing the story. And so in some cases I've had to ask people, you know, for example, I was interviewing someone who shared for the first time with me. It just came out, we were talking about their neighborhood, and I asked a question about the segregation of the neighborhoods. And this individual, an older Black man, started talking about the water hole that they couldn't swim in Baltimore, that was across the racial line, and how they went to that water hole one day and were caught by some white people, and they ran, but one of them was drowned in that pool by the white people. And he said he hadn't spoken about that in 60 years when he shared that story to me. He hadn't told anyone. Nothing happened. There was nothing they could do. It was, you know, they weren't supposed to be there in the first place. We had to stop the recording. It was a very emotional moment. And that's one of the things where you have to say, you know, should we stop? Because I think we were both in tears by that point. And you have to really be sensitive and give yourself time. And then, you know, are you ready? Should I turn the recording back on? That kind of thing. And then afterwards, I always check in if we have that type of experience. I always check in with the narrators and see how they're doing. Sometimes they'll share things, and I'll have to, even though they signed a release form, I will say, are you sure you want us to use this recording? Because we've had people talk about sexual violence, you know, lynching. I had someone name the names of people who were involved in a lynching in a county in Virginia that he's been researching for years, that never came to justice, but he knows the names of the people because of his work, and he insisted on naming them. And I said, are you sure you want to do this? And afterwards I was like, do you really want us to use this interview? Those are the type of questions I have to ask. I can't just say, oh, I have a legal document, you signed it and it's done. It's not like that with oral history. It's an ongoing relationship. And if that person doesn't want to share after they've said something, then we won't share it, for example. But you're right. Trauma is a very important, a very essential part of this work. And we have to be aware of it and take special precautions with the narrators and with ourselves, actually, as the people doing this work. And I keep a journal. I write about my feelings. That's one way that I get it out. I talk to the videographer that travels with me, because I learned on one of our journeys. Oh, I know we're running out of time soon, but I learned on one of our research trips that how impacted the videographer was, because they're filming. Right. And you don't, and sometimes you forget about them and they're quiet, but they're hearing the same stories also. So we have to talk things through with each other as well. So good question. Thank you for asking that.
Kelly Elaine, how many stories have you gathered?
How many stories? That's in my life. I have no idea. I've been doing this for over 30 years now. So hundreds and hundreds. Yeah, that's an excellent question.
I want to turn to you, Bob, and sort of follow up on, you know, when people talk about something they haven't talked about in 60 years or something like that. I've found, generally speaking, as a reporter, that sometimes people are hesitant to talk about something, but then other times people are ready and feel very empowered by finally talking about it. And Bob, I'm wondering, in your history as a journalist, have you encountered moments like that?
Yes, and there have been some of my best moments as far as the stories that you hear. And I'm not talking necessarily about the bad events, because our life isn't all just bad events.
That's right.
And some of the things that I remember when I was very, very young journalist, and I interviewed a man who is, I believe, in his late 90s. And he was telling me about, it was in Kansas City, and he was telling me about how there weren't paved streets. That's how far back he went. And his house was the first one to get electricity. It's very interesting just to hear the development. I remember he was telling me that there were even bear walking down the streets in early Kansas City that he came to when he first started. And now it's a major big city with skyscrapers and everything. So, I mean, it's not just the bad things, but it's a whole person's life that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely amazing. And in that life, there are ups and there are downs, good and bad. But they're lived, and that's what counts.
I'm going to go to an email that just came in from Maggie. Yeah, Maggie writes, and Kelly Elaine, I'm interested to hear what you have to say about it. Maggie writes, the term Juneteenth is infantilizing and demeaning. I do not understand this choice. Have you heard that before?
I have not, actually. It's just, you know, language. It's June and 19th. And as we know, African-Americans have a very rich oral tradition. They have a history of doing, you know, wonderful things with the English language. Also, they bring in some of their West African traditions without knowing exactly where it comes from. So there are many different reasons why we are able to do creative things with language that others may not have done before. So it's just a mix of June and 19th. There's nothing.
Yeah, I'm wondering if Maggie's, this is an email, so and I don't know Maggie, but I'm wondering if she's thinking it's such a cute word and it should be more dignified or something like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an interesting perspective. I've actually never heard it, but, you know, I'm not surprised some people may feel that way. But I think if you study the holiday and study the African-American oral tradition and languages, then you'll understand it a little bit more. And it is, I mean, as Bob was saying, the day and our stories are not all trauma. There's the part of that is also joy. And Juneteenth is important because you are celebrating that you are here. You made it. And then when I do an oral history, even if someone is remembering something that's horrible, I also am aware that that person is there speaking to me. They survived, right? So Juneteenth is about celebrating as well that you are here with your family. You're able to love and share food and, you know, break bread and dance and listen to music and play with the language because you survived. You survived to continue to fight, right?
And I'm wondering, you know, here in Maine, there are celebrations planned for Wednesday. Are there places in this country where there's pushback against the Juneteenth holiday? You know, we're hearing, pushback about the teaching of Black history in schools and things like that. And I'm wondering if we're seeing that with this holiday as well.
We are.
Yes, go ahead, Bob.
We are in one way, and then I'll let Kelly Elaine finish with that. But you stop to think that this is a national holiday. It's also a Maine state holiday, and not all states have claimed it as a holiday. So Maine is in the forefront of this.
All right. Yes, people are pushing back against the teaching of slavery, the teaching of Black history. But that's why Juneteenth becoming a national holiday is so important, because you have to know that today is a holiday, and then you have to ask that question, why is this a holiday? Then you have to look into the answer for that. And so no matter who you are, you can't escape the fact of enslavement of a huge segment of this population for 250 years, right? So there's no way that you can even understand Juneteenth without looking at the history of that. So there's no way around it, really, now that it's a federal holiday. Now, will it always be a federal holiday? I don't know. I hope so.
Well, it sounds to me, as we wrap up, Kelly Elaine, like you might recommend, okay, even if you're not going to go to a celebration event on Wednesday, maybe go online and read some history and learn something you didn't know before.
Our website, by the way, has tons of history. The National Museum of African American History and Culture. If you go to the website, tons of resources about Juneteenth and about African American history in general. So I really encourage people to go to our website.
Well, I so appreciate both of you giving me your time today. The voice you just heard, Kelly Elaine Navies, who is a museum specialist and oral historian with the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History history and culture. Also with us for the hour, Bob Green, a journalist, author, and Maine historian. And again, don't forget to tune into Maine Public Classical on Wednesday from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. for a full day of Black artistry. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can visit mainecalling.org for our audio archive and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Each week, each Friday, our newsletter lets you know what is coming out the next week. And right now, there's a little bit of a contest. If you do, there's a drawing for a mystery book bundle for people who sign up for our newsletter at mainecalling.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.